Stay tuned for The Cinema Clash, as Maryland-based critics Charlie Jewell and Hannah Buchdahl debate the merits of new releases, from the mainstream movies that Hannah tends to favor to obscure foreign films that Charlie likes to champion. It's free-flowing, unedited conversation with an occasional wine wager. Two very different perspectives, one entertaining podcast. Let the clash begin.
Hello and welcome to this dry prohibition era capital T total episode of the Cinema Clash podcast. I am Charlie Jewell of charliejewell.com.
And I'm Hannah Buchdahl of chickflicks.net.
Like, I know we're not actively imbibing, but I think we've already both had one prior to us joining to record this episode. So maybe that still counts.
Yeah, it counts because I had my little final summer sangria this evening because the weather outside is absolutely amazing. And so we should be outside, Charlie.
I'm not recording outside, but I had a half liter of German Pils at a beer hall in Arlington. So, busy day to day work.
You know what I mean? Obviously, yeah, really.
We combined this week on one documentary, one Broadway musical, and then we went our separate ways. I saw a doc you didn't see. You saw a thing I had no interest in seeing, and we'll put all that on the back end on the solo hour.
Yes.
So let's begin. It's not the biggest of the week, but it's a thing, because the entire world right now, or at least the entire country, is in remembrance mode. It's 20 years since 9/11. So Apple TV Plus has gone ahead and made available a previously shot Broadway musical. Think Hamilton. But it's not Hamilton. It's Come From Away. I'd never heard of it. I'd never heard of it. However, I am very glad I sat down to watch this wonderful, wonderful musical, even though it's far more talking than musical and singing.
It's a music
Hannah,
drama.
Who's coming from away, and and where are they landing?
They come from away, the plain people. First of all, though, I saw Come From Away on it came through D.C. on its way to Broadway. It actually did a run at Ford's Theater, and my niece and I saw it with the same, primarily much of the same cast as they worked their way to Broadway with this show. And I remember not loving it because it did feel more like a drama, like a stage play, than a musical to me at the time. And I had to acclimate to the idea that it was very minimalist and you had actors playing multiple roles on this set. But so what's interesting is that I found myself actually, I think, enjoying it more this time around watching it on film. And Come From Away refers to this group of people that were on planes that were ordered to land when airspace was closed, in light of what was happening in New York. So basically, planes were told, you must just land at the closest airport. And so in the town of Gander, Newfoundland, they suddenly found themselves overrun by plane people.
You don't see.
I do. But they're a very hospitable lot. And so this musical drama, as I'd like to call it, it tells the story of how people just came together to support each other and to help these strangers in a strange land, and how the people of Gander helped the plain people who had nothing with them other than maybe some of the luggage and they might have been able to get from the cargo hold. But it's just a very sweet story, and it was true. It's based on a true story of what really did happen with I think there were like 30 some odd planes that landed. And it's just, there was a couple that actually met while they were in Gander and ended up getting married. And so their story is just sort of being put out there. I think the Washington Post just did a big story on it this week. And yeah, so Come From Away is just it's just a really good, feel-good kind of reminder of how everyone really did feel, that they were kind of coming together. The whole world was really supportive of Americans back then. So yeah, so Come From Away, I do think is definitely worth watching. Even, you know, I'm the big Broadway musical fan, and so this was one that I kind of sensed that that you would like as well.
I mean, if you can make a feel-good story out of 9/11, I think they did. The cast is actually rather small mm-hmm. because each of them play 2 to 3 to 4 characters, and they do it seamlessly. You know immediately, even though it's the same person you just saw as the pilot, you now know she's in townie mode. I think it's very tongue-in-cheek how they pull that off, and they're very earnest as they do it. This is the same company who filmed Hamilton for Disney Plus, so they know it. They have experience in doing this. Hamilton, that, you know, what we saw last year, that was filmed years ago. This was actually filmed earlier this year, kind of a double celebration. So why we have this, they filmed it probably for this time period, for Remembrance Day.
Well, I think
they also did it in the spirit of Broadway reopening, Broadway revival. We're back, because they're applauding to be back in the theater.
But the audience was filled with first responders. So they were people that were specially invited in New York for this particular presentation. And so that's what made it extra special too. But I love how you just sort of feel like you're going into the show. So you're not really reminded. There are no cutaways of the audience throughout. Once you are in it, you are like in the front row watching this show with other people, but you are absorbed and you are focused. And so it kind of opens and takes you into the theater. And then you realize you're like sitting down amongst other people, and then it opens and you are right there. And then what I loved is what they could do at the end of this production that that you wouldn't necessarily see at the end of a Broadway show is you get the photos of the real people. So you see who these various characters are modeled after, and it's just a reminder of the fact that these are real people. These were true stories. And so, yeah, if you're going to watch something that doesn't reflect as much the horror of 9/11, but more the capacity and compassion of people, then I think to open their doors to strangers, then I think Come From Away is certainly worth seeing, especially if you've seen it before and you just already know you like it. This is worth a rewatch. And if you've never seen it before like you, then I think it's a good introduction to it.
It's better for your soul than any documentary you could sit down and turn on, you know, and then at 8:15 a.m.
right.
this happened, and then at 9:03 this happened. You know, this is just much better for your soul. It's
about
people doing good things in a bad time. Huge thumbs up for this.
Uplifting story, so definitely gets a thumbs up.
Speaking of uplifting, let's climb mountains. It seems about every year. There's a documentary that comes along that I would just call mountain porn. It's usually following a climber or climbers as they do the impossible, as you sit back in the theater or on your couch going, why? Why would you do that? This time, in 2015 it was Maru, 2017 it was Mountain, 2018 is the one everyone still remembers, which won the Oscar for Best Documentary, Free Solo. If you remember that guy who went up El Cap in Yosemite, sans rope, and
Alex.
Sans common sense.
Alex Honnold.
Well, Alex, you'll see him again in The Alpinist, which is not about Alex, but Alex is also shocked and awed by one Marc-André Leclerc. I believe Mr. Leclerc is from British Columbia. And in this annual dose of mountain documentary, he is very similar to Alex. He climbs things with no support. He just goes to the base of something and starts climbing. But it's not dry like Alex. He's not in the desert. He's not, you know, hanging out in dry rock. He's mixed climbing, so going over multiple weather and terrain things. But he's usually doing it in the snow or up the ice, like frozen waterfalls. Hence, the documentary is called The Alpinist. He does that with his trusty 2 ice axes and crampons. You know, and it's the best parts of this are when it just turns off the score and it turns off the voiceover, and we just hear him. We just hear him grunting and just finding the next crevice and digging in the next axe and hoisting himself up. It does that a couple of times, and I think that's when it really gets most effective. Mark is not the world's most willing subject. He said, yes, you can follow me. And they followed him for 2 years. And then I think he regretted it. Because halfway through, he just up and disappears. This guy's got some mad mountain integrity. He Free Solo to him means solo. I'm alone. There's no drone following me. There's no dude with a camera already at the top waiting for me to go to the top. It's him alone doing these impossible things, not as most climbers do it for Instagram, for Insta, for Facebook posts and likes. He a lot of times he does these things and you only find out way after the fact in like some blog post. So the alpinist shows a different character than we have seen before. He isn't, LeClaire is not in it for the fame. He's not. He's not in it for the notoriety. This is a guy who just needs to climb. He needs to climb things, and it has to be risky, otherwise he probably won't even feel anything, and it won't feel like an accomplishment. The Alpinist is not the best documentary I have seen about mountains or climbers. It's not the worst. It's right there in the middle.
Yeah, and I, you know, these, the subjects of these films, it was the same with Alex with Free Solo. I remember thinking, I just don't like this guy very much. I just don't particularly, I just don't feel anything in terms of watching him do his thing and from a personal standpoint. And they always have, these guys always have that girlfriend who's just sees charm in their social awkwardness. Like they even, that's their thing, is that I'm attracted to his social awkwardness and that he just is this free spirit that's going to do his own thing no matter what and live in a stairwell. And so it just, I mean, the whole thing, that's always been interesting to me because we saw that a little bit in Free Solo too with Alex's girlfriend. And we meet Marc Andre's girlfriend in this one. But the reason we don't see as much of the stuff that's really good that is him climbing and grunting is because the cameras just didn't capture it. He did. He would just vanish instead when they were all ready to go follow him. He was nowhere to be found. And that had to have been incredibly frustrating for the filmmakers. But it's also why we'd never heard of Marc-Andre LeClaire. And, you know, he's 23 and just liked to climb alone, far from the limelight, just wasn't his thing. And so, you know, you just watch it, I think, for waiting to see if he was going to fall off the mountain. That's really why everyone watches all of these things, and I think that's why the filmmakers film them, is to just see if they happen to be in the wrong place at the wrong time, so to speak.
That's a bit of a more macabre yes. viewpoint from you than I'm used to. Usually I would say something as crass like that, and you would defend, how dare you? People just want to see people doing amazing things against nature.
No, if somebody wants to, I'm more of a cynic than you were. I felt that the ending went on for too long. To me, this movie have been 80 minutes long.
No, instead, I think it had to end like that.
I disagree. So I didn't particularly care for the way it wrapped up. And I thought that it dragged the ending out for 15 minutes beyond what I felt like it needed to be. And so, yes, I'm much more of a cynic than you in how this plays out at the end. But, yeah, I just found it doesn't have that visual appeal of Free Solo.
The filmmakers had choices to make. You could see the film they wanted to make, and their subject really wasn't letting them. And I see both sides of that. They wanted to film Marc-Andre because he's climbing things in a way that nobody else on Earth is doing. Nobody else is doing what he is doing. Hence, we have to film you doing it. And I see it from Marc-Andre's point. Fine, but I'm going to climb it first, and then maybe you can film me the second time I do it. Or, you know, just kind of just stay away from me, man. Like, this is religion to him. I really see it both ways. And the end, they had to make a choice. And this is one of the ways they could have done it. There are probably other ways. I can't fault them for what they did. It would probably be a huge discussion point or Q&A during any Q&A session or as people leave the theater that, you didn't have to do it this way, but here's how you did it, you know, through no fault of your own. But, it's not that, you know, as I saw someone online put, this is Free Solo, Frozen Edition.
It is, but you don't have that immersive experience of the climb, just the nonstop waiting, you know, climb that you get with Free Solo. You are with them. In Free Solo, you are every step of the way, literally there, and you don't get that intense experience, I don't think, with with this particular film. You get the big sweeping, you know, wide shots and things like that. But I did also learn that who knew that alpinism was a word, that it was, they were studying his contributions to alpinism.
I think I suffered through alpinism for like a week in college once. I got my alpinism is acting up.
So if you want to learn about Marc-André Leclerc's contributions to the world of alpinism, then you can check out The Alpinist.
Well, you went ahead and you watched probably what the biggest film on this podcast is this week. It's something called Everyone's Talking About Jamie.
Everybody's talking about Jamie.
If you're in D.C., you can actually see this in a movie theater, at one movie theater in Silver Spring, the AFI Silver. But the rest of the world can wait
1 week.
1 week and see it on Amazon Prime Video when it starts streaming next Friday. But Hannah went ahead and saw it for you. I read the one paragraph synopsis and said, no, thank you.
And I think it's a mistake because I think you actually probably would like Everybody's Talking About Jamie.
Probably.
This is one that I saw on the West End with my niece. So my niece was my theater buddy for both Come From Away and from Everybody's Talking About Jamie. And when we were in London a couple years ago, everybody was talking about Everybody's Talking About Jamie. It was the hot ticket. We ended up getting one of those last minute opportunities to get a seat. And so it was a very intimate theater, very small theater, kind of theater in the round type of environment. And we just really enjoyed the show. And so this is unlike Come From Away, where I felt kind of closer, like I was really up by the stage to watch this one. Come From Away is not showing you the stage musical. You know, it's not a production. It's not a film production of the stage show in the way that Come From Away is. So Everybody's Talking About Jamie is also based on a true story and true characters. And it's a heartwarming kind of coming of age story. And it stars this guy, Max Harwood, as Jamie New. And Jamie's this teenager from Sheffield, England. And he dreams of a life on stage as a drag queen.
Don't we all?
And his best friend and his loving mom are both very supportive. But his classmates, of course, are not. They're
no, what a shock, really.
Not the nicest about it. But he does find support from a local drag legend, Miss Loco Chanel, played by Richard E. Grant. Oh. So the cast of this film is very good. It also stars your gal from Together.
Oh, Sharon Horgan.
Sharon Horgan, which we just talked about last week. No, my guy is James McAvoy, who she was in lockdown with in that film. But Sharon Horgan is in this as well as sort of a career counselor who's like a little skeptical of Jamie's choices for a career. But it really is just one of those be yourself, teach people to be accepting, step out of the dark into the spotlight, do your thing, be true to you kind of story. And really strong cast. It just is one of those ones. It's not a great film, but you'll just sort of enjoy it. And it's just heartfelt. And it reminded me to some degree of, it was kind of like Billy Elliot meets Kinky Boots in its vibe.
I like Billy Elliot.
And they were both excellent indies, Billy Elliot and Kinky Boots. And so if you know those films, you kind of would understand where this one's coming from. And so would I run out to the theater to see it this week? Probably not. But if you're home on, and you've got Amazon and you've already seen Come From Away and you're looking for your next theater musical adventure, then Everybody's Talking About Jamie is certainly worthwhile.
Off the top of my head, you got me thinking about drag queens in film. And I know we recently saw one that was very brief, but it was in Joe Bell. Remember that?
Uh-huh.
But here's one. I don't remember the name of the film. Maybe you can help me remember. Jennifer Aniston, she's a pageant mom, and her overweight daughter wants to do the pageant thing, even though she's never, and there's a huge drag queen sequence in there as they help her become a pageant beauty. For the life of me, I cannot tell you the title of that.
No,
film.
I can't either.
But I know you know what I'm talking about.
I totally saw it, and it was very good.
But yeah, I will probably end up watching Everybody's Talking About Jaime on Amazon next week.
Yeah, and it again, based on a true story, and so it's definitely a nice film.
Well, I saw something based on a true story, and I hope so, because it's a documentary, and we've heard about the people. And anyone who wants to can go watch it right now, because it is currently on Netflix. Blood Brothers, Malcolm X, and Muhammad Ali. I have seen multiple documentaries about Muhammad Ali. I have seen multiple Malcolm X and one Spike Lee biopic about Malcolm X, and we've all seen them in the same room last year in a wonderful film by Regina King called One Night in Miami, mm-hmm. which was nominated for and won plenty of acting awards. But now, Marcus A. Clark is here to tell us the story of those two in particular. Now, they didn't spend a lot of time together, hence why this documentary is a little thin. So the first third of it is, this is where they're coming from. Malcolm's from Harlem, spent time in jail. Cassius is from Louisville, Kentucky, went over to Rome, won a gold medal, came back to Kentucky. Oh my God, the world's not as racist as Kentucky. Kentucky sucks. There's a problem in this country, and I'm going to start to be very vocal about it. Hence, that is their new trajectory, how they came into each other's lives. Malcolm back then was with the Nation of Islam, with the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, and he found in Cassius Clay a celebrity. I'm going to not necessarily use him, but I'm going to guide him to his new faith. And so the second third of it is their time together. Not long. A couple years. Brings Cassius into the fold. And then the final third is Malcolm X's famous split from the Nation of Islam. He could no longer abide by the Honorable Elijah Muhammad's personal lifestyle. And he became, you know, he said, hey, this holy man, your holy man, has 8 children from 6 different teenage sister wives. And instead of saying, oh my goodness, we need to replace the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, the Nation of Islam got mad at Malcolm. Well, you shouldn't be in his personal life. And so, you know, he was marked for death. And Muhammad Ali, who was his brother, his blood brother, these two men loved each other, took the side of the Nation of Islam, and even after Malcolm X was assassinated, he said, had it coming. Ooh. Had it coming.
Harsh.
It is. It's actually a very jarring. I've never seen that clip before. It's very jarring. So I learned, while I didn't learn a lot, I knew who they were. I knew where they were coming from. I already knew about their time together. And I knew that Muhammad Ali stayed with the Nation of Islam long after Malcolm X was assassinated. I did not know about that clip, which is just jarring. He's okay with the murder. Everybody knows who did it. Everybody knows. They're not, and he seems okay with it. Now, it seems that he had regrets much later in life, which, you know, he never said anything on film, but his family saying he regretted it. Not the best film. It's just too thin. It's too thin of a story. These men, you know, they met more than a few times, but they didn't really do anything together because they just split and there was bad blood. So I posted about this and I said, you know, it's a thin documentary. I mean, if you really want to spend time with these gentlemen, One Night in Miami is still out there if you haven't seen it. So I get this troll. I get this troll who worms his way out of the woodwork. And he says, nothing about Blood Brothers. He says, One Night in Miami is a horrible liberal fantasy. And almost everybody is horribly miscast. Well, A, I think the Oscars and SAG Awards would have something to dispute you about that. But then I look up this guy. It's like, oh, it's probably some troll. No. He's got a website. He's a critic. I'm like, have you lost your mind? I'm not going to name him. I've never heard of him. Have you lost your mind, sir? Have you lost your mind? Horrible miscast? Liberal fantasy? Sir, this happened. There was One Night in Miami. Anyways, I was so shocked to have seen that. So, Blood Brothers, you know, it's one of those black and white. Oh, okay, I hadn't seen those pictures. Okay, I hadn't seen that newsreel. But you know the story already.
Yeah, which is why I just wasn't inclined to watch it. I did enjoy One Night in Miami, so why mess with a good thing? But I did, I went a separate way. Well, I guess you'll talk about the other drama, or was it a dark dramedy perhaps, that you saw.
There's no Eddie about it. There's no Eddie.
It was called, they were touting it as such.
Oh.
But, so, can in keeping with my 9/11 theme, I did go back this week and watch Worth on Netflix, because a lot of people were really talking about Michael Keaton's performance as Kenneth Feinberg, who led the September 11th Victims Compensation Fund and had to sort of assign, figure out what is each life worth when relatives of victims of 9/11 were, rather than have them sue, Congress created this fund and created this position for Kenneth Feinberg to lead this fund. And it was a way to circumvent a bunch of lawsuits happening that could break the economy. You know, if you had people suing every airline that was involved in 9/11, anyone who constructed a beam in the World Trade Center, I mean, it was like the potential for lawsuits that could drag on for years and cripple the economy was so high that Congress very rapidly established this Victims Compensation Fund. And Feinberg was well known as an attorney and mediator who specialized in distributing funds and assigning how much people were worth. And it's again, based on a true story, based on a very alive person who still does this kind of work. But it's really to kind of show how compassion needs to be kind of factored in to the equation when you are trying to figure out whether the janitor at the restaurant at the top of the world is worth as much as the Cantor Fitzgerald, you know, multi-million dollar staff that was there, and the first responders that died. So it's a very subtle, low-key film and just very engrossing and interesting. Doesn't focus at all on, you don't see the horror. It's not, it's again, what made it easier to watch is that I was not in the mood for another revisit of the audio and the imagery and all those things that I still remember are very fresh in my head. I don't need to relive all of that. I like seeing a different perspective. And so I'm glad I went back and saw Worth, because I do think it's possible Michael Keaton his name might still be circulating out there for award season, because it's just a very understated role.
Is he effective?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then I saw the real guy on a clip talking about the fund, and I really felt that Michael Keaton did a good job of really embodying this guy's demeanor and the way he would try and calculate things, and they did this all pro bono, which I don't think I ever realized that Feinberg and his firm took this on, and it was a very tough assignment, and so you appreciate, I think, more just how thankless a job this was. And Stanley Tucci's in it as well, and is also very good as sort of a community organizer, a guy who had lost his wife on 9/11 and was very distrustful of this fund and didn't think people should sign on to it. And so the dynamic of kind of each of them learning about what drove the other person and what the motivations were. It's Tucci as well is very good in it. So really good acting.
Stanley Tucci is always good.
He is.
But yeah, Worth does seem like it's right in my wheelhouse. It's just, you know, so many movies, so much
That's
time
right.
in your life, right? So instead of Worth, I went to in my safe wheelhouse. I like little grimy, dirty indie dramas. And boy, is there one this week. Small Engine Repair, which is from a 2013 off-Broadway play. Speaking of Broadway again in this, but off-Broadway.
Off.
The writer, director, and actor of that, John Polano, has transferred it to film. And works just fine for me. He brings along, not star power, but people you've seen before. He brings along Joe Bernthal, who usually plays like not the bad guy, but the guy you don't want to hang out with in that movie, like in Fury and Baby Driver. Okay, he's a bad guy in Baby Driver. And Shea Whigham. He's a character actor. Pops up a couple times a year. You remember Good Will Hunting? And, you know, but Chucky and the other two guys, like Casey Affleck, they were in Southie, and, you know, they're having a good time at the bars, but you can do that in your 20s. Imagine what Chucky and Casey Affleck and Cole Hauser was the other one. Not talking about Will. He's gone. You know, imagine them 25 years later. What their lives are like. This is those guys. They're not in Southie, though. They're in Manchester, New Hampshire, which, to mock it, they usually refer to as Manch Vegas, because Manchester has nothing to do with Vegas, but Manch Vegas. You know, these are blue-collar guys who've been in Manchester their whole lives, and they're going to die there. They've had a falling out. It's been a couple months, but Frank, John Polano, the, you know, writer, director, actor, calls everybody back together. It's like, hey, I got some steaks. I got some high-end booze. Let's, you know, bygones. Let's have a good night. Just us bros. They've been together since kids. This is bros. Water under the bridge. Little do Sueno and Packy know that they are there not really for bro night. Frank, later on, is going to throw a left turn at Albuquerque into the evening when an unexpected guest shows up. And it has to do with his daughter, Crystal. We've seen Crystal, Sierra Bravo, earlier this year. She was Tom Holland's wife in Cherry. Remember, he got her addicted to drugs after he came back from Iraq. Quite the performance. But she does a wonderful job. She doesn't have too much heavy lifting to do because she's not part of Bro Night. She's not there. But it revolves around her because they love her. They've all brought her up together as, you know, they're as like single dads do because mom's not really in the picture. And then, you know, about two-thirds of the way through, Small Engine Repair reveals its secret. And things happen, things go sideways. You're like, oh man, how you bros gonna get out of this one? And that's, you know, really interesting to me. It's very well written. You know, you think he's writing himself into a corner, and at times I just couldn't figure out how they're gonna get out of this sticky situation. And so I was not in love with Small Engine Repair, but I was enraptured.
Well, I saw it listed as a dark comedic drama. And so I watched the first 15 minutes. I'm like, I'm not getting much of the comedic out of this.
There's no comedy.
And
in
if it's dark comedic drama, then you know it's going to take a turn.
It did.
And I was like, I don't feel like taking this turn with them.
So you actually don't know what happens.
So I don't
know. You have no idea what that turn is.
I don't know what happens. So, yeah, you'll have to tell me when we're off the air. But because I don't think I'm going to go back and watch it. But I just, it's one of those ones where as you're getting into it, you're like, well, this can't end well. And so that's kind of why I just left it at that and decided it was more worthwhile to see.
I think it would work just fine as a stage play. You know, you always say, I know, I felt it like a play, and I don't really like that in my movies. And I don't know if you picked up that vibe at all. I didn't know until later, until after the film, that it had been a play. And then I could see it. You know, I could see this on a stage.
Yeah, but yeah, then I'm sure that that's why I go to musicals.
I don't think I can make a musical
like,
out of this one.
bring on the music, baby, because this kind of stuff, dark, twisted, not necessarily what I would want to see off-Broadway either.
Well, speaking of dark and twisted, let's go ahead and talk about Ted Lasso. Just kidding.
Roy Kent. We're Roy Kent.
Roy Kent's actually, you know, so it's over now. All 8 episodes are now available on Apple TV+. No, there's nothing dark and twisted about it, even though there is minor conflict finally towards the end of the season, especially involving, once again, the character I can just not wrap my mind around is Nate. Nate, the Wonder Kid Wunderkind. He does something at the tail end of episode 7, which I just don't get.
You don't like him.
I just don't even get it.
You just don't like him.
So, they don't wrap that up, by the way. But, yeah, it's no Ted Lasso. I saw someone talk about, people are voting right now for the Emmy Awards. All the nominations have been out. You know, the Ted Lasso season 1 was nominated for everything over and over again. Crazy amount. Dozens of nominations. But they're voting right now. And people aren't loving season 2 as much as season 1.
Well,
and so they're wondering, is that going to affect its vote count?
I don't know, because I do think that people are just discovering Ted Lasso. So I think they will get some goodwill out of the fact that for a lot of people, they're just catching up. So they're actually still watching season 1. They're catching up on season 1 so that they can start and get through season 2, which is only 8 episodes. So you can actually binge it pretty easily and be all caught up. And so it ends really also more with, you know, there were new characters injected into this season with the doctor, with the psychiatrist for the team. And there's some really, there's some good dark, you know, not dark, but deeper stuff explored with these characters at the end. And I just think that it sort of redeems itself by the end with the drama that it's showing and with the character development. Nate really is the only one that I just didn't like anymore.
Well, it's just he gets his like own episodes, yeah. And like, okay, I can see, you know, they're really building him up, bringing him out of his shell. He's a coach now. He's learning how to coach and how to lead people, and they just continually make him stumble. And yeah. Like, what is going on with this guy?
Well, we're gonna need maybe season three will give us the more of the Coach Beard backstory, and we'll get a little deeper into what he's doing. But you got a little bit of the payoff of where things were going with the online relationship, the text relationship with the boss lady and one of the with the boss lady and whoever she's texting.
Yes.
So you get some resolution on that.
Which doesn't really work either. I don't believe a word of that.
I don't believe it either.
Not one second.
I did have an issue. I didn't find it very believable. But I still love the Roy Kent and what's her name?
Keeley.
And Keeley stuff. I mean, the fact that they've managed to hold it together. And we get a little bit of insight into Jamie Tartt. And into what sort of drives his annoying ego. and so you're getting little dribs and drabs to potentially set up, you know, some deeper character development with a whole lot of people. And I still love Ted Lasso because to me it's still just a very well-written, entertaining half-hour drama that you can and dramedy. That you can just kind of just sit back and watch and just get involved with these people's lives. Like, I just like the characters, for the most part, that have been established over the course of now two seasons. And as long as the writing can sustain and some of these key characters can sustain, then I do think Ted Lasso still deserves the Emmy buzz that it's got, because I think just the fact that you're able to kind of keep, you know, keep it going and make it about more than soccer or football.
Well, Jason Sudeikis and company said when they came up with the idea and how they were going to show run it, they came up with three seasons. That's the arc. So we got one to go, and it's going to be a wait. So, you know, don't froth at the mouth waiting for season three, episode one, but, you know, depending on how that lands, I don't know if, like, I could see in my head where this is going, but I don't know how they could make a season four, because I could see how they could wrap it up at the end of season three, and then, you know, you're done.
They could have wrapped it up. I mean, the end of season one was really good. I mean, it was really, really good. And so, in theory, one season, it could have been a one season arc.
But right now, they don't know how to get past three.
So I don't know. And I think that's okay. I think I like when there's a plan and they can just end it on a high note. So if they're able to sustain through three seasons and then those writers can go off and the actors can go off and do something new and fresh.
You just
fresh.
Want them to make the Roy Kent show.
I do. I mean, without a doubt, the season was the Roy Kent season. There's no two ways about it. And he held his own, and I think he was just, to me, just such a fun character. Whether or not I could watch a show centered around him, like, day, you know, one after another, I'm not sure. But as a scene stealer, his language and his attitude, his character, I just love.
And there you have it. It's a kind of an odd shove it all in there from all corners episode, but somewhat Broadway focused for whatever
reason. It became very stage managed. But the one we did not see that I think also might be bigger out there this week is The Card Counter with Oscar Isaac and Tiffany Haddish. She's been on everything promoting this, and Ty Sheridan and Willem Dafoe. So very good cast in The Card Counter, but it's another revenge thriller, and I'm okay with missing that. I tried watching Afterlife of the Party on Netflix because it started playing.
We're the wrong demo for
Oh
that.
My good, totally. So that is like total teen demo with the people who ever go, whatever happened to Victoria Justice? You could, totally missed the boat for you. But if your kids were a little older, you'd know who Victoria Justice was. But that one is strictly for the teen crowd.
There you go. Well, I don't really feel like wrapping this up. You know what we talked about.
That's right.
I just say, I think the best thing I saw this week and what I recommend out of everything we talked about is Come From Away.
Yeah, I think
that's
for,
my favorite.
I think for commemorating 9/11 weekend, that's going to be the most uplifting choice you could find.
Well, thank you very much for listening to this most odd episode of The Cinema Clash. I am Charlie Jewell.
I'm Hannah Buchdahl.
Thank you.
Take care.
The Cinema Clash with Charlie Jewell and Hannah Buchdahl is heard twice each weekend at 5:15 on Saturday and 12:15 on Sunday afternoon. Join us again next time for The Cinema Clash.